The evidence is overwhelming.
Billions of years.
Science has settled this.
But has it really?
He's a double major, physics and astronomy, holding a PhD in astrophysics from the same universities that teach what he now dismantles. He's also a published author, a Fortis Fellow, and a Christian who believes the Bible means exactly what it says. This is In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
Was there really a global flood at the time of Noah? Were there really two of every air-breathing land animal aboard Noah's Ark? Is the biblical narrative compatible with what we know from science? Hi folks, I'm Dr. Jason Lyle, president and founder of the Biblical Science Institute and fellow at Fortis Institute. Today we're going to look at the biblical evidence and the scientific evidence for the global flood. Now, throughout early church history, it was common knowledge that there was a global flood during the days of Noah, in which Noah and his family were spared aboard the ark, along with two of every air-breathing land animal. And it's well known that most early scientists were Christians. Indeed, most of the founding fathers of various disciplines of science were Christians, and that includes the science of geology. It's been known for centuries that many rock layers on Earth were laid down in vast horizontal sheets, and they contain fossils. Basically, remnants of organisms now turned into stone. And frankly, most of these fossils are marine organisms, animals that lived in the ocean, and yet they're found in rock layers on land. In fact, we even find fossils of marine organisms on Mount Everest, the highest location on Earth. Naturally, early geologists interpreted the rock layers as having been deposited by the global flood, as recorded in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. The fossils are the remains of the organisms that were killed in that flood and buried in sediment, which has since turned to rock. But in the late 1600s and early 1700s, secularists began to challenge that idea. They didn't like the fact that most scientists were Christians, and that they used the Bible to guide their thinking, and that they had been very successful. And so these secularists proposed the idea of uniformitarianism, which is the belief that rates and conditions today are representative of rates and conditions basically throughout time. And in particular, it's the idea that Earth's geological features were formed primarily by the slow and gradual processes we see in operation today, rather than the catastrophe of a worldwide flood. So the idea is the flood didn't produce the mountains, rather mountains were building up over very long periods of time. The idea is that the flood didn't produce something like the Grand Canyon, but rather the Colorado River carving over very long periods of time eventually carved out the Grand Canyon. Now, make no mistake, uniformitarianism is an attack on Scripture. And this attack was predicted by the Apostle Peter in the third chapter of his second epistle. He speaks that scoffers would claim that all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. And so these scoffers would reject a global flood, and that's exactly what we're seeing today. But if there was no global flood, and the rock layers were deposited gradually over long periods of time, then the Earth must be much older than the Bible teaches, millions of years old at least, and eventually that number rose to billions. Now, this paved the way for Darwinian evolution in the 1800s, because evolution requires vast amounts of time in order to sound feasible. Even though the idea of millions of years was introduced to challenge the Bible, many professing Christians began to embrace this concept. And if the rock layers and fossils within them were deposited over vast amounts of time, then there could not have been a global flood, because such a catastrophe would destroy any previous fossil record. Even today, Christians who believe that the Earth is billions of years old generally deny a global flood. But doesn't the Bible teach a global flood in Genesis 6, 7, and 8? Well, some Christians have argued that Noah's flood was just a local flood, limited to the Mesopotamia Valley. And so the first question we want to address is this: does the Bible teach a local flood in Noah's time, or a global flood? Well, let's look at the text. In Genesis 6, we learn that all mankind had become very wicked, and the Lord planned to destroy them along with all land animals. Verse 7 states, quote, "The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them." Now, notice that God includes the land animals and also birds. Well, why is that? Well, God gave man dominion over the animals of the earth, according to the early chapters of Genesis, and so man's sin affects them as well. But notice that birds are included. But birds would not be destroyed by a local flood. The Pacific golden plover flies from Alaska to Hawaii when it migrates. And of course, there's no land to stop and take a break. This shows that birds can travel amazing continental distances. They could easily escape a local flood. In Genesis 6:8, the text says, "But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." So Noah and his family would be spared, and two of each air-breathing land animal, including birds, that were on the ark. But what about the animals and birds that were not on the ark? Well, in Genesis 6:17, God says, "And behold, I, even I, am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish." Now, that certainly sounds like a global flood to me. But here's the clincher. In Genesis 7:19-20, we read, quote, "And the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered." Now, would a local flood cover the mountains? That's absurd. Only a global flood will cover mountains because water seeks its own level. So the Bible is very clear. In verses 21-23, we read, "And all flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth, and all mankind, of all that was in the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, died. Thus he blotted out everything that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth. And only Noah was left, together with those that were with him in the ark." So there is just no doubt that this was a global flood that destroyed all humans and all air-breathing animals, including birds that could easily have escaped a local flood. But some professing Christians just really want to believe in billions of years, and so they must reject a global flood, regardless of all these verses. I have heard some professing Christians that say, well, all doesn't always mean all. It wouldn't have to be all the mountains on the earth that were covered. Well, actually, it's true that sometimes the Hebrew word for all is actually limited in scope, just like our English word. When a teacher says to her students, "Did you all do your homework?" she means all of her students, not all people on earth. So could all the mountains really just mean some of them? Well, no. When the Hebrew word translated all is used multiple times in the same context, it emphasizes that it means absolutely all. The Hebrew word translated all is kol, and it's used twice in verse 19. All the high mountains under all the heavens. The heavens would be the sky, which of course completely surrounds the planet Earth. So the Lord is emphasizing that each and every mountain on planet Earth was covered with water. So there's just no doubt that the Bible teaches that the flood of Noah was global in extent and destroyed all life except for those animals and people that were on the ark. In fact, the recession of the flood waters lasted 150 days, according to Genesis 8:3. And Noah and his family, they were on the ark for over a year. Now, no local flood would last that long. According to the Bible, what was the purpose of building an ark? Well, it was to preserve life. But if the flood was just a local flood, then why didn't Noah and his family just move to another part of the world? I mean, they had over 100 years to do it. Why would anyone build an ark the size of an ocean liner and take land animals, two of each kind, including birds, to spare them from a local flood from which they could have easily escaped? Again, birds can easily travel tremendous distances on a continental scale, but they could not escape a global flood. That's the reason for the ark. If Noah's flood had been limited to Mesopotamia, then the ark would rapidly be carried out into the Persian Gulf because Mesopotamia is open on the south. You can't fill half of a bathtub when it's open on one side. It would rush out to the Persian Gulf. Yet the Bible teaches that the ark landed on the mountains of Ararat, which is on the north side of Mesopotamia. And it must have been one of the taller mountains that the ark came to rest on, since it came to rest before the other mountains were visible. Mount Ararat itself is 17,000 feet above sea level today. Now, that's not going to happen with a local flood. Furthermore, what was the purpose of the rainbow? According to the Bible, it was God's promise never to send another global flood. But if it was just a local flood and God was apparently promising never to send another local flood, then God has broken his promise thousands of times. We do, after all, have local floods. You know, the Apostle Peter predicted nearly 2,000 years ago that scoffers would reject the global flood. 2 Peter 3, verses 5 through 6 states, "For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water." Peter was exactly right. He was writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, who knows all things, including what people will do and say in the future. And indeed, scoffers do reject the global flood today, but not for logical reasons. After the break, we'll come back and look at the scientific evidence that confirms that the Earth was indeed subjected to a global flood.
And we'll be back with more from Dr. Lyle in just a moment. Scoffers. That's Peter's word. And Dr. Lyle just showed us exactly what it means. 2,000 years ago, Peter wrote that men would willfully forget the flood. And here we are right now in our day watching that happen. We're watching it happen in classrooms and the textbooks that are being created, documentaries that you see on TV all over the world. That's the environment your kids and your grandkids are being raised in, which is exactly why a resource like the Fortis Plus app matters a little bit more than what it might seem to you on the surface. Everything that Dr. Lyle has recorded at Fortis Institute as a fellow is available for you on the Fortis Plus app, absolutely free of charge, and it's ready for you to share with the young people in your life. Everything that Dr. Greg Gifford has recorded is there as well, along with Dr. Adam Tyson, Pastor Brad Bigney, Libby Clausen, Dr. John Krotz, Todd Friel. It's all sitting there on Fortis Plus, ready for you to consume. I'm talking hundreds of hours of audio and video content, and it costs nothing. The entire thing, you can fit it in your pocket because you can put it on your phone, absolutely free of charge. Put this on your phone, put it on the young person's phone that's in your life who needs to hear something that's the opposite than what they're hearing from secular teachers and friends. And look, what keeps all of this free is a group of amazing believers, phenomenal people. We call them gospel partners around here, and they've been impacted by something that they've heard here at Fortis Institute, so much so that they wanted to make sure that everyone would have access to this content at no charge. And that's exactly what's happening right now. We are grateful for all of our gospel partners, and we want to throw out the offer to you. If you're not already a gospel partner and you have the means where you might be able to join us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner, we want you to start looking at what it might look like in your life to join us. You can visit FortisInstitute.org right now to start researching that. All right? FortisInstitute.org. Peter said the scoffers would come, and they came right on schedule, didn't they? Dr. Lyle's about to show us exactly what the rocks themselves have to say about it. This is In the Beginning.
For me, when I study the universe, I'm studying the handiwork of God. I don't know how secular people do it. I don't know how they can enjoy something that they think is just chance.
And now back to In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
Welcome back, folks. Again, this is Dr. Jason Lyle with the Biblical Science Institute and Fortis Institute, and we've been discussing Noah's flood and the fact that the Bible teaches that it was a global event in which all the mountains under the entire sky of the planet Earth were covered with water. And the Bible is not alone in that detail. There are other legends of a global flood in which people and animals were saved on board the ark. I remember reading one time the Epic of Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh encounters the Noah character, who's called Utnapishtim, and he recounts the global flood in which he was saved on board the ark. Some of the details are different. The ark is a cube in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which would not make scientific sense. The biblical narrative is clearly the original because it gives dimensions of the ark that make sense, that would actually survive a worldwide flood. And we've had engineers like Tim Lovett who have studied the dimensions of the ark and found that it is, in fact, scientifically ideal for weathering a global flood. But the fact is, there's a great deal of scientific evidence for the global flood as well. And this is something that has been challenged by secular geologists, but I would argue not so much on the basis of evidence, but on the basis of their assumption of uniformitarianism. Secularists have adopted a philosophy by which they interpret the evidence in light of the assumption that the majority of Earth's geologic features were produced by the kinds of slow and gradual processes we see today, rather than a catastrophic global flood, which would easily push up mountains at a rate that's much quicker than they're being pushed up today. But the fact is, we do find sedimentary rock layers on the surface of the Earth. All the continents have sedimentary rock layers. These are rock layers that have been deposited primarily by water, and we find fossils in them. And this is exactly what I would expect to find if there was a worldwide flood. It's going to kill lots of organisms. It's going to bury them in sediment. And then if you get certain minerals like calcite that will move through the sediment and lock the grains together into rock, and you'll end up with these massive horizontal rock layers that contain fossils within them. The fossils are where the minerals have sort of replaced the structure of the organism, and you end up with a stone in the shape of the organism, or sometimes a cavity where the organism was and has decayed. Additionally, most of these fossils are marine organisms. They lived in the ocean, and yet we find them on the highest mountaintops. So there's little doubt that the Earth was once underwater. And in fact, most secularists would agree with that. They just don't think that the entire Earth was underwater at the same time. They would argue that, yes, Mount Everest was once, you know, underwater, was once under the ocean. Now, the rock layers that contain fossils are divided into sort of three categories, with Paleozoic being the furthest down, then Mesozoic, and then Cenozoic. And we would argue that these are likely due to the flood, with perhaps the top part of the Cenozoic being post-flood. But secularists interpret these rock layers as having been deposited gradually over hundreds of millions of years due to their philosophy of uniformitarianism. But there are several lines of evidence that challenge this slow and gradual deposition. First of all, the fact that we find fossils within these layers suggests catastrophic burial. Most organisms do not fossilize. You've probably seen an animal that's been killed and left by the side of the road. It doesn't slowly turn into a statue over millions of years. It decays. It's recycled back into the environment, and that doesn't take very long. In order for something to fossilize, it has to be protected from environmental decay. In other words, it has to be buried rather quickly, and under the right conditions, minerals can move through it and can turn the sediment surrounding it into stone. And there are many indications that this happened very rapidly. For example, I've seen fossils of fish in the process of eating other fish. I've seen a fossil ichthyosaur fossilized in the process of giving birth. I've seen fossils of terrestrial organisms buried right next to marine organisms. Now, obviously, they don't live in the same environment. It would take something like a flood for that to happen. And a lot of times, the terrestrial fossils that we find are in a sort of death pose. They have their neck bent back as if they're struggling to get oxygen. And that suggests that they were buried rapidly in flood conditions. Now, we know that fossilization doesn't take millions of years. Scientists have been able to fossilize organisms in a matter of days. Furthermore, we know that rock doesn't take millions of years to harden. If you've ever used concrete, concrete is basically artificial sedimentary rock, and it doesn't take millions of years to harden. It just requires the right conditions. We've also found that in a given area of the world, the fossils that are deposited there tend to come in a certain order. Now, evolutionists interpret that as the progress of evolution, which you would think, well, you'd have the simpler organisms on the bottom and the more complex ones at the top. But that's not what we find. Even the very bottom layer of fossil-bearing strata, which we call the Cambrian, has very complex organisms in them, such as starfish and clams and brachiopods and so on. These are very complex organisms, but the one thing they have in common is that they live at the bottom of the ocean. And so you see, that would make sense if the flood were responsible for these strata, because it would bury the organisms that live lowest first and then work its way up, and then finally getting to organisms that live on land and so on, while continuing to deposit marine organisms with them as the floodwaters rise. And this is exactly what we observe. The other thing to note is that the layers in the Paleozoic and Mesozoic, and some in the Cenozoic, are continental in scope. That is, you can trace a rock layer from one end of the continent to the other, and there'll be maybe sections where it's missing, but there are other sections where it's continuous, which indicates that the scope of deposition covers an entire continent. Now, that is simply not happening today. We simply don't have continental-level deposition occurring anywhere in the world today. But that would have happened during the worldwide flood, because all the continents were buried, and so the sediment would have been deposited on a continental, even a global, scale. As I mentioned earlier, we find marine fossils on Mount Everest, and secularists say, well, that's not a problem. It was once the ocean, and then it got uplifted. But there's a problem with that. You see, continental crust is actually less dense than oceanic crust. And so the continents sort of float on top of the mantle at a higher level than the oceanic crust does. And so it doesn't make sense that Mount Everest was once oceanic crust. It's made of different stuff. It's made of the lighter stuff. It would never have been ocean basin, but it would have been covered with water during the global flood. Now, some people have put out the objection, well, there can't possibly have been a global flood because there isn't enough water on the Earth. And that shows they haven't done their homework. The Earth has contour, it has relief, it has ocean basins, and it has mountains. And if you could smooth out all that relief, the Earth would be completely covered with water to a depth of 1.6 miles. So there's plenty of water on the Earth. Dr. John Baumgartner has a really powerful model of how God might have used plate tectonics to both cause and end the worldwide flood. In that model, runaway subduction causes the continents to be pulled down into the ocean a bit, and that allows water to flood them, as well as, of course, water coming from the sky as well and flooding them that way. And then as they move to their final positions, they end up bobbing up towards the end of the flood because, again, continental crust is less dense than oceanic crust. So this model is perfectly consistent with what the Bible teaches about the global flood, and it's consistent with the scientific evidence. But can all these sedimentary rock layers really have been deposited that rapidly? Can canyons like the Grand Canyon really form so quickly? Doesn't it take millions of years? Well, a lot of people thought so until 1980. But in 1980, something rather remarkable happened. The first eruption of Mount St. Helens. And there have been some other eruptions since. But when Mount St. Helens erupted, it produced many new layers of sediment, some of which have now lithified into rock. Moreover, it also carved out a canyon about 1/40th the scale of the Grand Canyon in a matter of hours. So we now know that these things that secularists used to say take millions of years, we know they can happen quickly under catastrophic conditions. And frankly, Mount St. Helens was a rather small volcano by volcanic standards. The global flood was far more catastrophic. The Bible says the fountains of the great deep burst forth, perhaps referring to underwater volcanism. In any case, it was a tremendous catastrophe, far greater than Mount St. Helens, and therefore did the kinds of things that Mount St. Helens did, but on a global scale. One of the lines of evidence that these rock layers on Earth were not deposited gradually over millions of years is polystratic fossils. These are fossils that span several layers of strata, showing that they had to have all been deposited very quickly, one right after the other. For example, there are trees that span strata. Well, we know how that happens now because Mount St. Helens did that. It uprooted the trees and deposited them in the nearby Spirit Lake, and they tended to float vertically because the base would get waterlogged and so on. And so we now see how this happens. It doesn't take millions of years. It takes catastrophic conditions. Did you know that it is often the case that footprints of organisms are found in lower strata than the fossilized bodies of these organisms? Now, that makes no sense if these strata were deposited over millions of years, but it does make sense if there was a global flood. The animals are walking along, leaving footprints. The flood comes and fills in those footprints with sediment. The organisms are lifted up. They eventually drown and are buried in a higher layer. There's a lot of stuff like that, but the bottom line is that the science confirms that yes, there really was a global flood, just as the Bible teaches. Thanks for listening. God bless.
This has been In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, a production of Fortis Institute. Our website is fortisinstitute.org, and it is your central hub for all things Fortis. If you've enjoyed In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, consider subscribing and sharing with your friends and church family. Also, would you prayerfully consider joining this labor of love by becoming an ongoing monthly gospel partner? And until next time, go serve your